This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. And coming up, China's ambassador to Fiji flatly denies spying claims aimed at his country from Australia. How will Indonesia's promotion to the UN Security Council impact on its relationship with West Papua? And patience the key, as PNG's Dick Atua waits to see if a second Commonwealth Games gold medal will soon be hers.
Dika certainly deserves it. She was the first woman ever to lift in the Olympics back in Sydney 2000, and she's still going strong here in 2018.
The latest on the failed drugs test that could mean gold for Dick Atua later. Good morning, I'm Richard Hewitt. And first, it's the 4,000-kilometre internet cable that Canberra didn't want Beijing to construct. The high-speed undersea internet link between Australia and Solomon Islands was set to be built by the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei. But now it's Australia that will underwrite the project for the most part, with an official signing ceremony taking place in Canberra today during an official visit by the Solomon's Prime Minister Rick Ho. Matthew Doran reports.
Beijing's desire to flex its political and economic muscle is on full display around the world, including in Australia's backyard of the South Pacific.
I think what our government has realised is that we are in the middle of a really intense strategic competition with China.
Peter Jennings from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute argues it's about time more Australian aid dollars flowed to some of our most impoverished neighbours.
We're not as major an infrastructure player in the Pacific as we should be. And frankly, if Australia's not prepared to step up and do that in 5 years' time, the South Pacific will be every much a Chinese lake, as is the South China Sea.
Today, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and his Solomon Islands counterpart, Rick Hohenepwila, will sign on the dotted line for the first stage of a 4,000-kilometre undersea high-speed internet link between the two nations. And the backdrop for today's signing is especially acute, given Federal Parliament is soon to debate foreign interference laws. The Solomon's government had given the contract to Chinese telco Huawei in late 2016. 6 months later, ASUS boss Nick Warner told officials in Honiara the company shouldn't be allowed anywhere near the project for security reasons. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade stepped in with what the ABC has been told was a very generous offer.
We have had some concerns raised with us by Australia.
Rick Hohenepwila was quizzed on the deal by journalists in New Zealand last week, which will involve DFAT running the tender process and footing two-thirds of the bill.
I guess that was the trigger for us to change from Huawei to now the arrangements that we are now working with Australia on.
The Solomon Islands Prime Minister was in opposition when the deal with the Chinese company was struck and was highly critical of the process. Australia's concerns about Huawei aren't new. The company was blocked from building any part of the NBN, and there are new calls to ban it from any role in the development of the nation's 5G mobile network. Last month in Senate estimates, Daniel Sloper from DFAT's Pacific Division argued Australia had already been in talks with the Solomons and neighbour Papua New Guinea about such a project when Huawei was forced out.
We looked at options that could deliver that as fast as we could in a reliable, sound technology. Mm-hmm. There was an agreement between the governments that we could provide that in the time period they were looking for.
He said Huawei had not asked for access to the Australian network by the time Canberra stepped in.
At no point did that company, or in fact the Solomon Islands responsible telecommunications authority that would be submitting an application, put forward an application to Australia.
The decision for Australian taxpayers to foot the bill, which would cost the aid budget hundreds of millions of dollars, appears to have bipartisan support. Government sources have told the ABC Australia's Pacific neighbours should not be left in a position where they only have China to turn to for infrastructure investment. Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong agrees.
Obviously, there are a range of other nations who partner with developing nations in the Pacific, but Australia should be doing its part in the Pacific. It's in our interest and it's in the region's interest.
Australia's opposition spokesperson on foreign affairs, Penny Wong, handing that report from Matthew Doran. Now, apart from signing off on the undersea cable deal, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Rick Ho is also scheduled to have bilateral talks with his Australian counterpart, Malcolm Turnbull, as well as delivering a speech at the Australian National University on the future of the Solomon Islands-Australia relationship. The two nations signed a comprehensive security treaty last year when the regional assistance mission came to an end, but trade between the two countries is still lacking, and former Ramsey Special Coordinator James Batley says he expects Mr. Ho will be looking to identify new areas of cooperation.
Well, I think the relationship's in a pretty good place at the moment for a couple of reasons. I just think objectively there are no really difficult issues in the relationship. And I think the Prime Minister himself is well disposed to Australia. So I think from the Australian point of view, this should be a reasonably uncontroversial and friendly visit.
At the same time, given the broad nature of the agreement, the treaty that was signed last year, and also the follow-up aid, I think it was about $141 million over 4 years, would it be possible for you to maybe speculate on what Mr. Ho might seek to address in this speech?
Well, look, I could guess. I'm not sure what he wants to talk about. I mean, I think it will be important from his point of view to move the relationship beyond the Ramsay era. I think Ramsay was so dominant in the relationship over so many years, right until the middle of last year, that it's a good time to sort of take a fresh look and say, right, well, what is it? Where does the relationship go now? That agreement that was signed between the two countries towards the end of last year was about security in future circumstances where assistance might be required, and of course, so far that hasn't been required, and it's not an automatic security guarantee in any case. So, I think the Prime Minister will be wanting to put a positive spin on the relationship and to look for new areas of cooperation.
So, the security relationship between Solomon Islands and Australia is quite strong, especially in light of that treaty. But how are we tracking in terms of an investment relationship?
Oh, well, look, our economic relationship between the two countries is pretty thin, you'd have to say. There's very little trade between the two countries. In fact, almost two-thirds of Solomon Islands' exports go to one country, and that's to China, even though they have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. So certainly, the economic relationship is not a particularly strong one. I think one area that the two governments will want to be talking about is this whole area of labour mobility. There's a lot of scope for Solomon Islands to expand its participation in this scheme in Australia. It's been relatively slow on the uptake compared to some other countries in the region like Vanuatu or Tonga. But it really needs the sort of benefits that this scheme can bring. So I think I'm hoping that would be high on the agenda of discussions between the two prime ministers.
James Batley, former special coordinator with Ramsay, the Regional Assistance Mission, and former Australian High Commissioner to Solomon Islands. He was speaking there to Michael Walsh. You're with Pacific Beats here on ABC Radio Australia, and China's ambassador to Fiji has rejected claims that a Chinese vessel was spying on Australia's largest warship during its recent visit to Suva. Several Australian media outlets reported claims that a Chinese spy ship had timed its arrival in order to conduct surveillance on HMAS Adelaide. But as Liam Fox reports, Ambassador Chiambo says Australia has a perception problem and the espionage claims levelled at Beijing just don't stack up.
The HMAS Adelaide docked in Suva on Saturday as part of Exercise Indo-Pacific Endeavour, but it wasn't the only large ship in the harbour. Also there was a large Chinese vessel, the Yuan Wang 7, notable for its two large satellite dishes on its deck. Over the weekend, several Australian media outlets reported unattributed claims from Defence Force sources that it was a spy ship fitted with communications equipment and that it had deliberately arrived at the same time to carry out surveillance on the Australians. But Ambassador Chiambo says the claim that the Yuan Wang 7 is a spy ship is nonsense.
It is not at all true that Chinese space surveillance ship is spying on the so-called Australian military ship. The Chinese ship is a scientific ship, mainly for checking the satellites when China has some missions of launching satellites.
He told Fijian media that the timing of the ship being in Suva at the same time as HMAS Adelaide was a coincidence.
The dates coming to the Suva port is decided long, long time ago. And actually, the Chinese space satellite ship comes almost every year, routinely.
Australian defence officials didn't seem to be too bothered by the Chinese ship's presence. Here's Captain Jim Hutton, commander of the Navy's Joint Task Group 661, speaking to the media on the deck of the Adelaide on Saturday.
We take the appropriate security precautions and it's just another ship.
Deputy Chief of Navy Rear Admiral Mark Hammond also played down concerns about the presence of the Chinese vessel.
Now, that's a space surveillance ship. It's a scientific ship.
Also on board the Adelaide was Australia's High Commissioner to Fiji, John Feakes, who said they had reached out to the crew of the Yuan Wang 7.
And we've invited the skipper of the Chinese ship to the reception tonight.
Oh. That's what navies do.
The claims of Chinese spying come amid heightened concern among some quarters in Australia at China's growing presence and influence in the South Pacific. Ambassador Qian Bo says Australia has a perception problem.
The Australian side needs to address its problem of perception on the China's development. And they should take China's development as a positive factor instead of looking at China through tinted glasses. This is not in the interests of the two countries and the two peoples.
He says the relationship between Australia and China has experienced some difficulties recently, and it's up to Australia to take efforts to repair it.
Once the problem of perception has addressed on the Australian side, then the necessary conditions for the true improvement and sound and steady development of China-Australian relationship certainly will be created.
Meanwhile, the HMAS Adelaide is due to visit several other South Pacific countries as part of Operation Indo-Pacific Endeavour. The Australian government says the exercise delivers on the promise to deepen Australia's engagement and partnerships with regional security forces.
That's our Pacific Affairs reporter, Liam Fox.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Richard Hewitt with you, and now that Indonesia has been elected to the UN Security Council for a two-year term starting in 2019, observers of the situation in West Papua are hoping that additional power will generate extra scrutiny on Jakarta and its relationship with the disputed province. A co-founder of the West Papua Project at Sydney University, Dr. Jim Elmsley, says Indonesia's promotion on the international stage is an important development that puts the Southeast Asian nation firmly in the spotlight.
I think that the appointment of Indonesia to the Security Council is good because it does throw more of a spotlight on Indonesia and, you know, the various fraught and disastrous things that are going on in West Papua, particularly the environmental sort of catastrophe and the human rights dilemma that's there. It does throw some light onto those and the more progressive elements with Indonesia, they don't want us to be seeing those things either. So I think it's possibly a good development.
These sorts of two-year positions on the Security Council that countries get, do they really have a lot of power, or is it more of a symbolic position?
I mean, the Security Council is obviously dominated by the permanent members, but it's a highly sought-after diplomatic posting and achievement, and countries go to huge efforts to try and secure it, as we saw with Kevin Rudd. So I think, yes, I think there's certainly quite a lot of prestige in it. Whether they can influence world affairs, probably not. But it does elevate the country on the global stage, which in some ways is a two-edged sword, because the problems that those countries are experiencing, they are also elevated. So in this case, when Indonesia is looking at trying to play a useful role in things like conflict resolution and peace building, then it becomes sort of incumbent on Indonesia to really take those sort of policies to heart in their own problems they're facing. And things like, for instance, these massive coal proposals and let alone the ongoing oil palm and other massive developments that are happening there, which are the drivers of conflict in West Papua, are one of them.
Do you think the Indonesian government in the recent months and years has shown more of a willingness to negotiate with West Papua, or have things sort of got even worse?
They have certainly paid lip service to try and fix some of the problems and some of the major dilemmas that the people are facing. Whether much has improved on the ground, it's hard to say. Certainly, things are getting worse, that's for sure. But other things like the land rights movement, there has been some positive developments in that area and in certain areas. But that all seems to be swept aside when there's a big, huge development like the coal farm plantations and mines and now the coal fields. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. But in general, the situation in the West Island is still very, very poor. And it is incumbent on the government to try and, well, if not solve, at least move towards a more reasonable way of behaving in relation to their Indigenous people.
Co-founder of the West Papua Project at the University of Sydney, Dr. Jim Elmsley. He was speaking there to Nick Fogarty. Now, the Papua New Guinea Weightlifting Federation is making tentative plans for Prime Minister Peter O'Neill to present a Commonwealth gold medal to Decatur should the winner of the 53-kilogram class at the Gold Coast Games, India's Sangeeta Chanu, be disqualified. Chanu is facing being stripped of her medal after she failed a dope test, and if a second test confirms that result, then Tua would be promoted from the silver medal position. Dikatua has been here before, and her coach Paul Coffer says these latest events are a rerun of what happened at the last Commonwealth Games in Scotland.
The same thing happened 4 years ago in Glasgow. That's the funny part about her. She was the recipient of the gold medal after the girl from Nigeria was found positive. And incredibly, the same thing happened now. It looks like Dika might finish up winning a second gold medal at the Commonwealth Games.
However, in Glasgow, the whole process happened quickly and Tua was presented with gold before the Games were over. But this time, with the test results emerging outside the Games, the president of the PNG Weightlifting Federation, Sir John de Winokura, says matters are likely to take a little longer.
At the moment, the longer the shorter it is, due process is being applied to give the Indian athletes the opportunity for the sample to be tested. How long it will take is anybody's guess.
Presuming the decision goes Dikatua's way, she'll get a second gold medal eventually, but without the Games razzmatazz, and Paul Coffer says that's a pity.
There's nothing associated with it, you know, just a medal coming in. It's different if you're standing on the victory podium. It's a different feeling. At the Gold Coast, that's what you're working for. Getting it months later, it's not the same.
Paul Coffer's assertion can't be denied, but once they get the go-ahead, Sir John de Winokura says they are planning to lay on as glitzy a show as possible for Tua, with Peter O'Neill presiding.
Would invite the Prime Minister to present the medal. So, yes, we will take stuff to the very, very top because it's a moment of pride for the whole of the nation, and we will give it the accolade that it deserves.
And PNG's former Olympic chef de mission, Sid Yates, who knows Dikatua well, says he has no doubt there will be a national celebration.
Dika certainly deserves it. She was the first woman ever to lift in the Olympics back in Sydney 2000, and she's still going strong here in 2018. So it'll be fantastic, and I think it would just give a big boost in Papua New Guinea as well.
But the bigger picture for weightlifting is still the question of what can be done to stamp drugs out, particularly when the sport is under threat of being kicked out of the Olympics. Paul Coffer says it's time for heavier penalties for guilty athletes and their countries because short-term bans are just not effective.
Nothing has been done much. These countries need to be penalised. One or two positives, you're out for 4 years. Simple as that. But you kick them out for a year, you let them pay. It means nothing. They've just got the money and they just keep doing it. And it's happening time after time. I never thought that in the Commonwealth we would have such a thing. And it has happened.
In contrast, Pacific Island lifters have an unsullied reputation. Sid Yates believes that's very much down to the way the Oceania Weightlifting Institute in New Caledonia is run, and he says another gold for Dikatua would reflect that.
Paul Coffer runs a very tight camp, and they've got a very strong stand against that. And look, it's fantastic for the Pacific Islands as well, not just Papua New Guinea, and it'd be a tremendous achievement if this does come off.
But right now, patience is clearly the key, because even if the Indian lifter's B sample is found to be positive, there is still a chance that the athlete could take her case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Switzerland. Pacific Beat. And we'll continue to keep a close eye on the situation as far as that potential gold medal for Dikatua is concerned. Now, Dr. Barry Kirby is a well-known face in some of the most remote villages in PNG, to where he will pilot his own plane or travel by boat to deliver healthcare for expectant mothers. And now he's been formally recognised by his native Australia as well in this year's Queen's Birthday Awards. As Bill Bainbridge reports, it's an honour that Dr. Kirby hopes will shine more light on his work to improve the lives of some of PNG's most vulnerable women.
Congratulations, Mama. Baby girl. Girly, girly. Okay, rub that up vigorously. Okay, we'll just feel for another baby here. Okay, I think we're right.
Another successful delivery. In 2015, the ABC's Foreign Correspondent program followed Dr. Barry Kirby around PNG as he visited some of its most remote villages.
Hello, doctor.
Hey, how are you? Nice to see you again.
His mission, to ensure women in PNG deliver their babies safely in health clinics and not at home, where maternal mortality is among the worst in the world. It's work that's seen him recognised in this year's Queen's Birthday Awards for distinguished service to Australia-Papua New Guinea relations.
It's an honour to be recognised by Australia for the work that we've been doing over the last 10 years in obstetrics, but even before that, since around 2002 when I graduated in medicine in PNG. So I guess it's an honour to be recognised for that, and I'm hoping that it'll spur us on to bigger and better things and eventually trickle down and have a positive impact on mothers in PNG. That's what I'm hoping it will mean.
But he wasn't always a doctor. In fact, it wasn't until he was 40 and working as a carpenter in Papua New Guinea that he decided he had to do something to address the appalling health problems he saw all around him.
I thought to myself, look, maybe I should think about changing my life and becoming a doctor so I could help people in this situation. And I could see that basic health care, not to be a specialist at all, but basic health care would be good, and I could make a difference. It wouldn't be too hard to make a difference in people's lives. So it prompted me to think about medicine. But I was lucky when I finally made that decision to, okay, down the tools and let's go back to university, the doors opened for me. Yeah, I was successful. It took 12 years eventually, but the image of people there and that, yeah, changed my life.
And he, in turn, has changed the lives of many women, in part by providing expectant mothers with a gift pack that includes nappies, clean clothes and a baby bath, items that he says help women overcome the embarrassment of their own poverty when they present to the health clinic and help the clinic staff feel positive about treating poor women from remote villages.
Staff feel good about it when they're giving something to the mother. It encourages them to... They have this more of a caring feeling and they get excited about it. So that worked extremely well. Crazy idea, but it increased supervised deliveries by an average overall by 80%, but some centres actually, there was a 300% increase in supervised deliveries.
But despite that success, he says there's still a long way to go, and his next aim is to change the attitude of men so they better support their wives.
I think the education of men is the way to go, and that's where we are focusing now. We're going to still continue what we do, but we need to get a message to men so that they actually become leaders in this. They knew what it was like to be a father and a warrior way back with Binyamya when I was there, and the man walked in front of the woman with bow and arrow and he protected the woman. But now it's changed, and of course, what is it like now to be a man in PNG and have the family? I think there's a lot of issues that men need to catch up on.
Queen's Birthday Award recipient Dr. Barry Kirby, and the reporter there was Bill Bainbridge. Finally, soccer fans right across the Pacific will be keeping a close eye on the World Cup when the tournament kicks off in Russia at the weekend. Sadly, no Pacific teams involved, but Australia will be there and the locals have given them a warm welcome.
It took more than 20 qualifying games and an estimated 250,000 kilometres of travel, but the Socceroos have finally taken to the field in Russia. At this ticketed open training session, there was at least one die-hard Australian fan.
There's nothing like it, you know, it's just a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
But the vast majority waving flags were curious locals rather than committed Socceroos supporters.
Who is your favourite Australian soccer player?
Who is your favourite Australian
soccer
player?
No idea? What do you know about Australia?
I know that capital is Sydney.
Of course, the lack of knowledge runs both ways.
How's your Russian personally?
Russian, you don't know too many words, to be honest.
The so-called Festival of Football is always billed as a chance for people from different cultures to get to know each other better.
And even though this World Cup comes at a time when Australia and the West's relationship with Russia is close to its lowest ebb in decades, the players don't seem at all concerned about the reception they'll get across the country.
James Glenday reporting from Kazan in central Russia and rounding out this edition of Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks very much for your company.